Hello, I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winner Mitchell. Hello, Winner.
Hi.
Journalist Margaret Wappler. How are you doing, Margaret?
I'm pretty good.
Good. And professor, critic, and DJ, Oliver Wang.
Hey, Guy.
Hey, Oliver. To help give you a sense of who we really are as human beings, I'm going to go around the studio and have each of you tell me what TV show, film, or song last made you laugh or cry out loud. Winter Mitchell.
The last thing that made me cry were any time those Google Christmas ads. Man, they just, and I don't care where I am, I am just gutted. I could be at the bar.
Where I'm not supposed to ask questions.
Right.
Margaret, what's the last thing that made you laugh or cry?
It made me laugh and cry. It was the Broad City episode where they are stuck waiting out a storm.
It's pretty great. Oliver.
It's a video of robot fails. My favorite being a robot that's supposed to pour your beer for you. And not only did it overpour the beer, but then its arm fell off at the end.
No, but what about the one where it's supposed to put the ketchup on the hot
that's
dog?
Equally good. See, winner knows what's up. Winner knows
really?
Robot fails.
Robot fails are sweeping the nation.
Yes.
Okay. Last thing that made me laugh was the British TV movie, The Long Walk to Finchley, about Margaret Thatcher's unspoken 20s, 30s years. It's hilarious. And last thing that made me cry, Viola Davis accepting that SAG award. That was pretty great. All right. Coming up this week, Nielsen's annual review of the music industry shows sales continuing to plummet almost across the board, while streaming services like Spotify and iHeartRadio expand. We'll talk about how we're consuming music and ask if this means the death of the album. Later, we'll all be sharing our top cultural recommendations, but first, what arts and entertainment has been worth our attention over the past 7 days? Margaret Wappler, what are you all about this week?
Well, I have been very engrossed in the reaction to the Salon essay by a writer named Ann Bauer. The essay is called Sponsored by My Husband, Why It's a Problem That Writers Never Talk About Where Their Money Comes From. So this has stirred up a lot of talk on social media amongst writers, but then I think it also applies across the arts to like filmmakers and musicians, visual artists, so forth. In the essay, Bauer writes that she's been financially supported by her husband for a while now, which has allowed her to make these big strides in her writing career that she couldn't before. And then she wonders why more authors don't confess to the privileges they have. And she points out these two writers in particular, one being a known heir to multimillions. He's giving a reading afterwards. Somebody asks, you know, how did you make it for the 10 years that you took off to write this book? And he's like, oh, I sold a few magazine articles. It was hard. and he never addresses this, you know, pile of money that he has to rely on. And then she talks about another author that she goes to see, like a 30-ish young woman, debut author, who same question comes up. How did you do this? And she says, well, I made the choice not to have children. And this really frustrates Ann Bauer because she feels like, you know, both of these answers are misleading and that the authors are perpetuating what she calls this like Marie Antoinette syndrome. She says those with privilege and luck don't want the riffraff knowing the details. After all, if those people understood the differences in our lives, they might revolt or, God forbid, not see us as somehow more special, talented, or deserving than them.
I really like and appreciate the honesty of the article. I went into it sort of scared that it was going to be constructing the life of a freelance journalist as some sort of like hobby for a housewife. Like I just
right.
went into it like from the headline with so much judgment, and I really appreciated the honesty of talking about these things, because in any creative field there is just that question of how much are you having to do just to sort of like pay your way to get through the game, and how much is somebody sort of like paying for you to be able to prove yourself and move along. And it's very true in comedy. I was just talking to Winner about sort of the significant financial difference between the people who go into improv and the people who go into stand-up. Mm. Like, if you are going into improv, that means that you need to have an extra $400 every 8 weeks. That's something that's not true for a lot of people.
Why the extra money?
You have to take classes.
Oh, like, I see.
To become an improviser in any town, you have to go fully through their class system. So, like, even if you were a well-respected improviser in D.C. or Boston, if you move to L.A., you have to take all five UCB classes and sort of keep taking classes until somebody then taps you to be on a Herald team and be part of the ruling class. That's why there's more economic and racial diversity in stand-up, though, like, because it is sort of a tougher, rougher game where there aren't structures. Like, there are fewer women in stand-up because you aren't going to a class where you know people. You're going to a space full of strangers. But in stand-up, like, we were talking about the number of billionaires' children who now have TV shows, and they don't talk about it. Like, Spike Jonze changing his last name. Nick Kroll never really talking about what his dad does. Like, I'm in stand-up, and I didn't realize that his dad was a billionaire. And he's a wonderful, wonderfully talented person, but also we want to have this notion that people who are successful because of bright and shining fire within them and not because a world gave them the opportunity to let that fire shine.
But isn't, like, desperation for your art, doesn't it make better art? I think any writer, painter, artist would prefer to have a pile of money to rely on, but there's something gritty and kind of empowering that you're building something, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and building something and creating your own vibe. I mean, I don't think Nicki Minaj, I think when you look at the people that's, I don't know why I even use Nicki Minaj as an example, but you think about, I think somebody so recent who's blown up so quickly, they started with very little. And then they built sort of this image around that. And then they gain the endorsement from the streets. They get that street cred and then they go on and do it. I would take her before I'd take Lana Del Rey, whose dad totally invested all his money into making her Lana Del Rey and it falls flat. You know what I mean? It's good, but then it's not good. It's inconsistent.
I do, but at the same time, I think that good art can come from anyone. I think it could come from a rich person. I think it can come from a poor person. I do think that, you know, it can come from a place of otherness. That I feel like is the most important aspect. And otherness can come from any kind of... any kind of life. But what I do think about this, that's so interesting about this article, is that she advocates for writers to basically out themselves, to out their privilege. And I just don't know that that is actually the solution to this.
No.
You know, because I don't feel like anyone, I mean, the guy that had the multi-$1 million, he doesn't really owe anyone an accounting of his family wealth. I mean, that's just not anyone's business. But at the same time, what I think is important about what she's getting at is that the arts are largely open to those with privilege. And if we can kind of change the system, if we can be honest about the fact that the system does work that way, maybe we can find a way for more people who aren't relying on family money or whatever money it might be to have a chance.
I also think that there's weird danger in the fiction of the person who had to work hard is gonna have more to give or more to sell. I mean, I think there is validity in it, but I'm also reminded of that thing in A Room of One's Own when Wolf is comparing Austin, who just sort of like sat in her parents' like parlor and didn't really have anything to fight against and didn't really have anything holding her back, versus Charlotte Bronte, who was pissed, like pissed at a world holding her back, and like that meant that she had more fire in her, but it also meant that pissedness got in the way sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know myself that pissedness gets in the way sometimes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You get in front of yourself.
I would also say, I think what audiences want is they want the Horatio Alger's mythology, right? They don't want to know that the people who are making their art, whether it's music or writing or whatever, are coming from a place of privilege. They want to believe the bootstraps. But I think going to the salon author's point, it's more in terms of other writers want to just know what the game is like, and they don't want to have that fiction sold to them if it's completely unrealistic. So I think we're talking about two different audiences for that piece. Was she writing for other authors or was she writing for readers? And it seems to me that she was writing primarily for authors because readers don't care.
Also, I think in any structureless field or a field where people aren't just making like a regular salary income, there is this sort of like, I don't know what my life is supposed to look like at this point in time. Like, so many people will like get on a TV show or something like that and just be in a mindset of, well, I guess now I don't have roommates and stuff like that, and sort of not realize like, no, a lot of people on TV shows still have roommates. Like,
but that's the highest criticism they give for Jay-Z, is that Jay-Z changed when he got money. And the thing is, I don't see that. I see the because I've followed him since the very beginning, I see the evolution of a man into his art. I don't see Jay-Z's getting paid now and doing Samsung endorsements. So Jay-Z's going to completely flip the script. He's if you're a fan and you like, you appreciate someone's work and you follow their, you know, their entire discography, then you will understand he's been sort of priming himself. He set himself up for this. And then he's telling you, taking you on the journey with him.
It's like he's been obsessed with capitalism all along. Whether he was a poor man or a rich man, he was obsessed with the system, the mechanism of it.
But it was it was more fun listening to him rapping about the crack game than about the corporate game.
Oh, gosh, no. When he started getting seizing that quan, it started getting real good.
Oliver, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about Deflategate. So for the other half of the country that could really give a hoot about football, so the Super Bowl is this upcoming weekend. It's the Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks. And the Patriots were accused of deflating the game balls in their last game against the Indianapolis Colts. And the reason why this is a big deal is that a slightly deflated ball is easier to throw and easier to catch. And the problem here also is that the Patriots have a history of being accused of unethical, cheating-like behavior. So this only feeds into that particular narrative. And as many predicted, once news around this deflation accusation, I mean, it's true. I mean, they actually measured the balls. The balls were under inflation. whether or not this was done deliberately or through some magical, you know, freak physics accident, who knows? But no one actually thinks it's a freak physics accident. But there's kind of a certain amount of hand-wringing, not so much around the accusations of cheating, but rather hand-wringing that this is a distraction from what we should be talking about, which is about these two great football teams who are going to meet on Sunday and blah, blah, blah. But to me, I think for people who follow sports and love the narrative of sports, this is actually fantastic because it's not – usually the lead-up to the Super Bowl is, you know, it's super inside football. People arguing over whose cornerback is better than whose wide receiver or who's – how do the offensive lines stack up. And, I mean, that's great if you're really into those nitty-gritty. But to me, this is sort of the bigger story around sports, which is around – gaining advantage, whether, you know, heroes and villains. And I think Deflategate really highlights all the great things that we love debating about in sports, which are sort of, you might describe as superficial, but I think part of that superficiality is actually at the center of why we like sports. And I mean, just the latest installment, and this came yesterday, is that there was video of a I believe, a Patriots employee taking two bags of balls into the bathroom for 90 seconds. And was he able to deflate 12 balls in 90 seconds? I mean, this is the level of where this discussion is at. But it's fantastic in terms of it's both kind of silly and it's scandalous. And as we all know, that is a perfect combination.
I love that there is a football organization that is evil. Like, you've had, like, you know, rough, like, you know, oh, the Raiders, a baby might get shot at one of those games. But, like the Patriots are such, like, corporate criminals, like, high-class nefariousness. It's wonderful. Winter Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
Oh, I am all about J-Lo's movie, The Boy Next Door.
Cookies.
It was amazing. I went and saw it Friday night, opening night. It made $15 million this weekend. It's on track for 30.
Was that good?
It was, listen, here's the thing that I'm going to defend about the movie. I love J-Lo's brand. I love the way she sets up the movie that you know you're going to see. There's going to be a lingering shot of her thigh in a nightgown. There's going to be some hazy, gauzy sex. There's going to be her getting up in somebody's face and defending her family and her rights to exist. And the thing is that she's so empowering in her role. She has so much conviction in every single time she steps to a role like this that I was all about it. Let's not forget that the guy that she's in the movie with, I wasn't really checking for him beforehand, but he is fine. And he is like, he's got it going for him. But the more talking about the sort of the business side of it is that J-Lo invested 80% of the budget. So $4 million against $5 million. Mm. And that means that she went with not the super duper styling team. She went with that. They didn't have craft services. There was not a ho-ho to be found that was purchased by the production. She did her own hair. She put her own clothes into it.
Why would you do a movie like this on the cheap?
You would do a movie like this on the cheap because, for one, J-Lo used to make a ton of money in movies. I think she got reached up to about $9 or $12 million a film. There is no more money in Hollywood. She's not going to get that amount of money unless she takes some risk. The studios are like, look, you got to take that risk. for us because, let's be honest, J-Lo, she hadn't made a movie in a few years, and her star was sort of like hanging on the balance, but she's really fought her way
back. But she wore that white suit and Made in Manhattan.
Which was on yesterday, and still to this day, the Dolce & Gabbana jacket is on point. Now, she also, it's a low budget, high concept, great ROI, but in contrast, Johnny Depp goes out again. This movie comes out of nowhere. Never even know that he's filming anything. And then it shows up on all the billboards and we're expected to see it. And it looks completely ridiculous, as ridiculous, if not more than the last one he did. And it makes $4 million.
I would like to make 2 points. A, I have not seen The Boy Next Door, but I love that J-Lo steered into the skid of January movies and was like, let's make the January-est January movie.
But she always, but for the, as long as her career has existed, January has sort of been her sweet spot.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so she really is able to sort of like seize the audience. But the thing is that the reason why this movie was good is because it's like a telenovela. It has all the saucy salaciousness. It's very current. Women, you know, older woman, younger man. She just had a younger man that she was in a relationship with. And you can make a movie on the cheap because technology is so much better. So, like, the risk she took paid so
hot
well
people,
off. That
hot
she's
people
maybe,
fucking doesn't require any CGI.
I'm telling you right now, he is so fine.
Winter, can
I was
you,
like, woo!
Can you confirm for me that he gives her a
yes!
first edition of the Iliad?
Yes.
First edition, people.
And then wow. This is what I say at the theater. I go,
3,000-year-old
No,
that's
but
amazing.
And it looked brand new, like it just came from Publishers Clearinghouse when you put the little sticker on the mail and you send it in and you get it like with plus 10 CDs. No, the thing that she, that wasn't what bothered me, okay?
But they had a hilarious
a
piece of sleep
edition,
this morning about it.
That's what she says. Yeah. No, what bothered me is why would he give her favorite book? As like the first, that's and that bothered me more than her having a first edition of it. I was more like, why would he give her favorite book?
Also, her favorite book is the Iliad. Also, she teaches high school classics.
Yes.
Also, it's a first edition of the
so
Iliad.
What?
It's just
so,
too beautiful.
I don't know from where.
Things have happened.
What is the most ridiculous part of the film for you?
I have to say that the 1990s Diet Coke scene where where the guy before she and him do it. Because they do it like right after that is he's like fixing the car and showing the son how to fix a carburetor. And it's like he's got like this Marlon Brando white T-shirt all rolled up and the jeans. It's like gauzy and it's like that quick camera look like a Diet Coke commercial, like a Cindy Crawford commercial. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. How much longer is this going to go on? And then I was like, knowing the trope of J-Lo, the very essence of a J-Lo of J-Lo's cinema. I knew that they were going to start banging her immediately after that. I was really only concerned because I've never seen a man have sex with a woman and keep her breasts covered up the entire time. I know that you go around there sometimes, but then you kind of hang out in other places.
Better or worse than that movie. Better or worse than that movie where Beyonce hit Allie Larder with a phone.
I'm sorry, Beyonce, but 100% better than
really?
That. There was sex in this movie. There was like real, like crazy sex and like oral. And then there was also like him being soups crazy. I mean, he was super crazy. He was really trying to get her fired. And she was not getting fired over that. Okay.
This sounds delicious.
Not today.
This sounds delicious.
It's delicious.
I like how Winter's voice drops an octave to say oral.
Yeah. Oral.
Speaking of delicious, you guys, this week I'm all about the television program Empire. It's amazing. It is a honestly good, tightly constructed drama. It's essentially King Lear, but with sons. Like Terrence Howard is deciding who he's going to give his music empire to. His oldest responsible by the books, not a celebrity son. His middle son, a semi-successful recording artist who is also secretly gay. Or his youngest son, who's just like raging hormones and anger and aggression. And just, you guys, just at the moment that he is making this very difficult decision and asking his sons to prove themselves, who gets out of prison but his ex-wife or his baby mama, Cookie, played by Taraji P. Henson.
Of course it's Cookie.
Who, like, the thing is it is a well-constructed drama. It like it's Game of Thrones with like good, interesting political sensibilities. Like Lee Daniels is smart. He just shouldn't be making Oprah movies. He should be making this. And like you just get the feeling. I know that it's not true, but in my heart, it feels true that they just said, like, everybody gets a script except Taraji P. Henson, and they just say, go be awesome for a while. Just go in to the scene in the first episode. Like, basically, Terrence Howard says to her, what are you doing? And she says, I'm going to show you that a faggot can run this empire.
Wow.
And it, because she, like, she grabs the middle son and is like, we're going to do this. The oldest son is, like, trying to pit the two younger sons against each other. And, like, politics is being played every way. But the level of awesomeness that everyone is throwing, but that she particularly is throwing down with in the second episode, somebody says something moderately aggressive to her, and without lifting her eyes, she just, I don't know whether it's editing or the performance or what, but the immediacy of her, say that to me again, like, it's just so, like, it's beautiful. And Taraji P. Henson, we got her in her late 30s and thought that she was an ingenue because of Benjamin Button and and what's the heart out there for a pimp? Hustle and Flow.
Hustle and Flow. Hustle and Flow,
yeah. And I just love that they swooped in to say, baby, you're in your early 40s, but we're here for you. Like, we get who you are now. All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about how we're all consuming music after this.
Hi, I'm Brian Fernandez, a.k.a. Sonny D., producer of Jordan, Jesse, Go.
I'm Lindsay Pavlis, producer of Wham Bam Pow.
We're the stars of Maximum Fun's first web video series, Brian and Lindsay Will Totally Eat That.
Someone throws us a snack, we eat it, and then we rate it on a scale from yummy to crummy.
We've recorded a pilot, and we're raising funding for the series on Kickstarter until February 20th.
And if we receive enough backers, we will receive a huge challenge grant from our friends at Hover.com.
Go to MaximumFun.org/totesy for more info or find us on Kickstarter.
Question for you.
Shoot it at me.
You gonna eat that?
Totally.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket, you guys. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Oliver Wang,
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler.
All right, you guys. We're gonna talk about music. Oliver, tell us what we're talking about.
So Derek Thompson, who is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, just put out a short piece, a relatively short piece this week, looking at last year's album sales as compiled by Nielsen. Let's just start off with the very obvious observation that we are now in, I don't know, year 10, year 12 of the death of the music industry. Right? That is nothing new. But what's interesting is that we are not that many years removed from saying, well, digital sales are now cannibalizing or digging into physical media sales. So CD sales are down because everyone's buying digital. But what last year's data suggests is that now even digital sales are falling. And so the idea here is it's not the death of the CD, but rather it's the death of people buying music in favor of the big rise of 2014 was in streaming. So that I guess if you had to project what the future could look like is that none of us really buy collectively, we don't really buy single songs or albums. Rather, we just buy access to a cloud of the infinite playlist where we can access whatever music we want. But it's no longer about the discrete unit of the song or the album having any kind of meaningfulness, which I think is pretty interesting because that goes very much against the entire 20th century of how music, you know, works and how it's consumed. And again, this is very early. We know that CD sales are down, and that's never going to recover. I can't imagine any scenario where the CD comes back. But the idea that digital sales are now falling and that people don't want to buy music digitally either, but rather just want to have access to the streaming services, I think that's sort of the interesting curve into where this standard narrative about the death of the music industry is going. And I know this very closely aligns with, you know, one of Winter's big interests around just social media, and this is very much tied into that. So I thought we could just throw out for discussion, do we see the end of music sales? Is that what the future looks like? And as a subset of that, do we see the end of the album as a organizing principle for how people buy music? Maybe we just all buy songs now, and the idea of 12 to 16 songs packaged to one is pointless in a digital cloud playlist, whatever era.
It seems to me that this is as much an economic question as it is sort of like a media question. I feel like companies licensed their music in the way that a bunch of movies were licensed to Netflix streaming before anyone even thought about it. Mm. And it became this cheap way to have access to like a huge library, and everybody ended up going there, like destroying this other market. And isn't the answer that Netflix is going to get more expensive, is that these music streaming services are going to get more expensive and maybe balance out the system a little bit more. I don't know.
I mean, that's certainly happened with iTunes. Like, as they've gotten more power, they've increased the rates of buying a single song or an album. I mean, so I do think that that has to happen with things like Spotify. I also worry personally about, like, what's happening to the artists and all this. I mean, I feel like, you know, you included a good link to that Boing Boing article about how Google, their streaming site that's coming up that's going to be part of YouTube, is already strong-arming indie musicians into these deals that aren't very beneficial for them. And this is why, personally, it took me a long time to get into Spotify, because I kept reading about how they were just jerking around people, and it turned me off from the site. That said, I personally do not buy physical CDs anymore. I just don't.
Well, I never thought about it.
Who has the space, frankly? Yeah.
I never thought about it this way before, but like, when iTunes splashed into albums and albums were $5 cheaper because you weren't having to buy an actual thing, it was like, oh, yay, they were able to save some cost and I'm saving some money, which is all true. But with only one major seller of music, it's kind of a monopolistic action to undercut the competition, destroy them, and then start raising your own prices. We used to have a thing called antitrust law in this country where we would bust up a monopoly. And we just really don't do that anymore.
Well, the thing is I think it's more, I hate to be so tough on artists today, but I think that if you're Beyonce and you do what you did last year, which is, or the year before last, and that you, with no warning, no notice, put your album on iTunes, that's the only way we can get it, so we can get right into the conversation and start digesting what you've put out. I think that only so few artists can do that,
right, yeah, right.
That you have to literally be like a Beyonce and have the team that's like Fort Knox to do it. Or you can be like Lil Wayne, who is putting the album track by track, or just doing a mixtape that's sort of not in his contract or it's out of contract, and giving it to the fans, and then let the fans stimulate the interest, and then you ask them for your money later on. I like Spotify. I think Spotify helps me know more about music and enjoy the music that I like consuming. But I'm just going to put it right out there. Ever since I was 17 years old, 18 years old, and I knew that there was a Napster, and I found out about it really early, I'm sorry. It's unless I really, 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 really respect the artist, I am not that tempted to go out and just buy 10 tracks when I know that it's going to be available and I'm going to hear it no matter what in other places.
Now, just to go off of that, do you pay for Spotify? In other words, do you Spotify Premium
or
do you use the free service?
I'm not an animal, Oliver. I pay for it.
Okay.
I don't want any ads.
All right. So you're still giving money that, I mean, it may only translate into fractions of pennies,
yes,
to this artist.
But I don't want it to factor into fractions of pennies, but let's be real. They go on tour. They charge me $300 for a ticket. They want
But who's making money off of that, though?
Well, I was going to say that at one point, touring was sort of brought up as the thing that could help save a
it
band.
Will.
But it will for some bands.
If you focus on being an artist and stop trying to be a reality star, stop trying to,
it also
to,
works
you know,
if you're like a 25-year-old, group of 25-year-olds who can tour
indefinitely.
What
is so wrong about taking your music to the masses and actually letting us have an acoustic experience?
But look at who controls the venues. Look at the ticketing services and the cuts
well,
that they're getting.
Well, go yell at those clowns. I don't like paying $500 for a ticket for anything, but if I'm going to have a good seat and I want to see Yeezus and I want to be front row and yell, then $500 it shall be. And that's okay. But I don't think that I can just turn around and if you're going to put out a 20-track album and I got to pay $40 for your latest album, that's a lot of money.
Do you think people think about the morality of this very, very, like, stealing music? That stealing music, we're more aware of it being questionably moral now than we were in 1998?
I don't think so, because I think it's become so normative,
yeah,
that you access music digitally and it doesn't matter if you're paying for it or not paying for it. I mean, I use Spotify, but I use the free service because, to me, I don't need the extra features. So in a lot of ways, I'm consuming this without actually having to pay the price for it. And
but you're
it
giving...
doesn't strike me as an ethically wrong thing to do. And I don't think a lot of people who are coming up in an age such as my students, for example, it doesn't strike them that there's anything ethically wrong here.
I mean, you are giving your brain space to those ads for the period of time it takes.
Sure.
You know, you're
right.
Letting them make some money.
But, you know, the thing that I really – I always think about is the first place I go, if I want to hear a song I haven't heard before, I just go to YouTube first. And certainly when YouTube was created, no one would assume that that would be the kind of principal site in which people at least initially consume music. Right?
Right.
The quality's not great, but that YouTube is as much a music service as is a video service.
Right.
And I think this is all part of the kind of brave new world rhetoric that we talk about. I mean, just to, I guess to come back to the core point here is, again, do we see this future where no one just buys music? We just pay for access to the infinite cloud, but not we're not giving money to any kind of discrete song or album or artist unit. It just we just want to have access to whatever we want to listen to, but there's no like direct point of sale to like a person.
It's interesting because I mean you're like, oh well, there still has to be quantification to figure out what's successful and what's not successful.
Mm-hmm.
But that also kind of rests on a notion of good competition, which when you're something that requires huge infrastructure like these things are, like competition isn't necessarily going to be there in the same way.
Yeah.
And also going off
of competition, but competition with the artist or competition with the company.
I'm saying between companies to have the,
well, they
the
just,
best
they're
artist
not going
to
give
quality.
Up any money. YouTube is not going to say, okay, you put this song on Vivo or it ended up getting you know, linked somewhere else, and we're going to, yes, we'll give you the 40 cents on the dollar for that.
But back to the thing we were talking about with that article from Salon, just that when you have, like, big players having this much authority about, like, what gets airtime, like, what people are having access to, you're going to have more possibility of us not having, like, a free competitive market of songs where I get to pick the one I like most, but just having companies take artists that they have relationships with and tell us this is what you're getting. And I realize that's the way music has always worked to some extent, but it's a lot more today than it was when there was a music label in, you know, every town in America.
But you can solve this by letting the artist have their digital presence host this announcement. You can give control. If you give the artist, like Rihanna did it with the Paul McCartney, her 4 or 5 second song with Paul McCartney and Kanye, she was the one who put it on her site first. And then you came back to the site and that's how you got access to it. And that's a smart way to do it. She owns the announcement. If, you know, we're always complaining and whining about, oh, the artists aren't making money, they're losing money, but they're not. They need to get around their labels and go into their
but
labels.
But Rihanna
and say,
can do that. You know what I mean? She has the mojo and the juice.
Though.
I don't think so. I think there are a lot of artists that cannot wield that kind of power with their
labels. There's tens of thousands of artists that are on Bandcamp or on SoundCloud, and that is their only means of reaching an audience. And that's great because it does mean they can bypass the label.
Right.
But on the flip side, how do you find them? And that brings us back to sort of the old-fashioned systems.
Yeah, I mean, the Radiohead, like Louis C.K., come to my website, download this, pay what you want to pay.
That's great if you're Louis
right.
or Radiohead. Yeah.
But you need a forum. But I mean, what we're talking about is has always required capital. It's always been
right.
MTV.
Right.
It's always been
radio.
Yeah.
I do think it all puts the onus on these bands to be super savvy, to really market, to use crowdfunding to their best abilities, because that is something they're going to have to do now, is like get their own money through their Kickstarters and all of that kind of thing.
I would love to just throw this to the panel here, and this is a very small sample, but would it bother you if the album disappeared? In other words, artists only release songs, but they're not releasing 16 songs in a package that we think of as the album. Would that bother you? Regardless if you're paying for it or not, it's not the money principle. Rather, it's the idea of the album. If that disappears, would it bother you? Guy.
I have the worst taste in music and only consume – like, I like a pop song.
Okay.
Generally, from an album, there's like one or two songs that I like. Like, there are lovely experiences, but we have that as a cultural trope, and people are still going to be able to, like, shape things and not have to have it fulfill the requirements of, like, we've been in this world of two sides of an album for a really long time, and, like, Beyonce self-titled, just, like, laying video on top of every fucking song is a first step. Now we can do an album that is something more like an EP, or we can do something that's gigantic. I think that's nice for those things that want to be a curated experience of an hour. I'm still me. I'm probably still just going to listen to all about that bass.
Okay. Margaret?
You know, I think it really depends on the artist. I think some artists, particularly with pop artists, like you can just grab the singles and it feels satisfying and that's really all you need. Like, I don't know if I necessarily need to hear like the eighth track on...
Meghan Trainor's new album.
Exactly. Like no that shots. To me is like Meghan Trainor is not who I'm going to get like the album experience. But I do feel like, you know, I'm going to talk about this later with the Jam, like Bjork, something like Bjork, I want to hear her idea of what an album is. So in that way, I hope that the album doesn't die. And I don't think it will for quite some time, because I think that's still, for artists, a great way to sort of package and conceptualize what they're doing.
Sorry, just very quickly. I do still love the pop acts that were able to pull the high jump of having all 10 or all 12 of those songs be pop hits. The fact that those Spice Girls albums managed to... Like, there's not a dud in the bunch.
Real quickly, too, I remember getting to... I've gotten into arguments before about what track number is the best on any album. Like, I will just tell you guys, number two on any given album always
say
rules.
That.
Oh, that's great.
I would not... I would be actually really upset if the album experience... Only because I was born in the 80s.
Yeah.
And only because Bjork Post is my favorite album from beginning to end. And only because OK Computer is my favorite album from beginning to end. And only because 808s and Heartbreaks are my favorite album. And the Black Album from Jay-Z. Like those albums, when you listen to them, I will put them on and listen to the whole thing. And I remember a moment in time. I remember how I felt when I first heard this song. And it's just something about being able to listen to an album and not have to turn from it, because we're such a culture now where we need, you know, something new quickly to change our mind or get us in a different. I just sometimes just will put on an album and I want to hear the whole thing and imagine I was there.
Best album experience of all time. What is the best composed album?
Jeez, you just throw that extemporaneously.
I'm sorry.
At the face and want it to land in a nice little puddle. Here's the deal. I can say that about a lot of albums. I can say it about...
Just say Beatles.
No, I will never say that. I am so sorry.
Sgt. Pepper's.
Hell to the no. Bjork Post or the Clueless soundtrack.
All right, you guys. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, everybody, I'm Emily.
And I'm Lisa.
We co-host Baby Geniuses every other Monday on Maximum Fun.
We interview comedians, musicians, cartoonists, circus clowns, and experts in the field of...
Vacations, the afterlife, cool recipes, self-improvement, fashion, candy, beach boys, girls, turtles, plot twists, women dating, fitness, presidents, hair removal, conflict resolution, Santa meditation, babies, modern dinosaurs, bullying, crop circles, the Beatles, middle-aged men, experts, teens, life hacking, rhyming, baby talk, personal organization, the name Dexter, Frasier, extreme eating, groceries, being a best friend, movement, Jam, art education, America's funniest home videos, stockbroking, spooky stories, genealogy, riddles, Pinterest, IT, magic, revenge, mothering, dogs, ayahuasca, Hollywood legends, street racing, fitting in, celebrity sex, the occult, personal training, the ocean, Dennis the Menace, modern poetry, sugar gliders, Jimmy Buffett, Franks, The Tonight Show with Gun, Johnny Carson, Mountain Dew, theme park safety, dinner parties, butterflies, raccoons, pasta shapes, and Bob Dylan. Join us every other Monday!
Yay!
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio,
Margaret Wappler,
Winter Mitchell,
Oliver Wang.
All right, every week on Pop Rocket, we'll be asking our panel, what's your current jam? And since I'm already running out of favorite songs, I'm going to broaden the definition of jam anything great in popular culture, which is technically cheating. All right, Margaret.
Well, I've been getting really into the new Bjork album. It's called Vulnicura. Kind of hard to say. It's her breakup album with Matthew Barney, her multimedia artist ex-husband now, and it's her ninth album. It's beautiful strings, but they're all very fraught with tension and anxiety and mourning, and we're going to hear a little bit of Family, which is in the center of the album. By now you're in it, things are really intense. You're going to listen to her mourn the breakup of her family.
Where I can pay respects for the death of my father, son, respect between the three.
So happy.
Exactly. So she's not playing around. There's a sound in there that almost sounds like a knife being unsheathed.
I love her! She's so amazing!
She's so intense, and she's just bringing her full powers on this record. In a lot of ways, this record reminds me of Homogenic, which actually is another breakup album of hers. That was with Goldie, who nobody really knows in the United States anymore, but I think is still a going concern in London.
Oh.
But all the same, it has some comparisons to that, except this one is just like far more devastated. I also want to give a quick shout out to a wonderful interview Björk has with the Pitchfork editor, Jessica Hopper, in which they talk J-Hop. About they talk about problems Björk has had historically in her career with not getting credit for her music. That commonly she'll bring someone else to do some kind of finishing touches, and that person will get the credit. Like, for instance, with Vespertine, Matt Moses, Drew Daniel, who's like a friend of hers, like everyone kept saying to him, "Yeah, yeah, you did this album, right?" And he himself would be like, "No, I didn't. I came in and did some percussion on top." But yet people want to give that kind of credit to him all the time and take it away from her.
Pretty sure women don't have creative vision. You guys are just vehicles for emotion, right?
Exactly. Vessels. Just great vessels.
Winter, what's your jam?
My jam this week is Dots and Lines by Lupe Fiasco. This is somebody else who's having a breakup, this time with his label. And Lupe is, it's not as emotional, it's really financial. He's just obnoxious and annoying, but he uses the word, he rhymes the word viscosity.
In
the, yeah, and I was like, okay. And the lyricism on this song is so beautiful. It's like a little, just like patchwork of just amazing grammatical use. And he sounds a little Illuminati-ish. It also it sounds like he's sort of saying, I'm giving up one devil for the other. But the fact that he sort of made this himself, made his own beats, wrote it, I'm really into it. And it reminds me a little bit of the Women in Red soundtrack by Stevie Wonder, which is also like there's a little, if you'll hear it in the beginning, it sounds like a country song, but then it kind of gets it totally just gets orchestral. It's amazing.
Hit it, Rockapella. You look just like how I'ma be. Sacred geometry.
So the whole point of him talking about dots and lines is dots and lines are supposed to mean the dots and lines you sign when you're signing your life over to in a recording contract.
Oh.
That's not about Morse code. I totally misread that
song. Me too.
Sacred geometry. I mean, I love that line.
Yeah, he's annoying, but this is a good song. He's a persona. Separate the man from the music.
Oliver Wang, what's your jam?
It is by a trio of teenagers out of Austin, Texas, named Charlie Bell. And the song is called Shake You Off, which is, of course, not to be confused with Shake It Off.
Falling for you seems like it was less like I just fell, maybe more like I was pushed. Sounds right. What am I supposed to do when you...
So I discovered this group through The Guardian, a newspaper out of the UK, which has a new music column. And I mean, what's great about Charlie Bell is that the singer that you hear, that is Jindai Bonds, who is 16 years old. On drums is her younger brother, who's 14, Gyasi Bonds. And then their bassist is, I'm not sure how old the bassist is, I'm going to guess like 15 or 16, named Zoe Zarnecki. So not only do they all have great names, but they're all teenagers, but they're making music that sounds like the Cranberries circa 1992,
oh, yeah,
when none of them would have been born.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a great kind of indie pop, dreamy, very, you know, yeah, teen. I mean, it's not teeny pop, even though they are teen, but it's just a lovely pop sound that I've just
mature.
Been listening to that over and over and over again.
How are the kids so self-possessed these days? Like, between, like, Tavi Gevinson of Rookie and...
The internet!
I don't want to know those self-possessed children. I want to know the 18-year-olds who are messes now when
yes.
they are 32 and have their shit figured out. Because they are us.
For reals.
Here, here!
All right, you guys. My jam this week, this is terrible. If the honest response to what have I listened to the most over the past week is the CBC podcast Power and Politics. You guys, I realize everyone's paying attention to like the Greek election melting down Europe, but some shit's going down in Canada and we never pay attention to it at all. Their economy is crumbling because they put all of their chips on oil and now oil is cheap. And I realize that this is barely a pop culture thing, except for the fact that, like, you don't get scraped down raw Canadian politics from any podcast online. And there's one podcast that's just giving you a solid smackdown of Canadian politics every week. And it's one of my passions, and I needed to talk about something other than homosexuality and women's voices.
How did Canada become your passion?
Yeah.
Because they're right next to us, but we don't pay attention to us.
So, yeah. Like a,
it's like the big TV show of the North that we watch. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's ridiculous, but, like, underserved voices have always mattered to me. And their
Canadians are underserved.
Their economy is going cray, and they're electing a new prime minister.
And they lost all their targets.
They're electing a new prime minister in October, and shit. The lovely thing is here, you're like, one of the two major parties will be elected. And in every Canadian election, there's always the possibility that one of the parties could just stop existing. It's happened twice in the last 30 years.
Parliamentary governments are fascinating.
They are fascinating.
Yeah.
All right, I will say this last thing and then we will go. I do, however, the people who make the, oh, it's just Coke and Pepsi in America, I'm like, yeah. But in countries with third parties, like, sometimes Diet Fanta gets elected, mm-hmm. and then you have to deal with Diet Fanta running mm-hmm. things for the next 3 to 5 years. All right, you guys, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wobbler, and Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks also to Jane Prana, Zach Hay, Nora at Uncover, Ohio Mike, Benjamin Keith 48, and Daniel Kaiser for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. It'll help get the word out. Get in touch with us on Twitter at PRPod. Join the Pop Rocket Podcast Facebook group and answer the question, what's the best album experience you've ever had? What album do you think gives the best, most complete album experience? We'll have a new episode for you every Wednesday and post show notes with links to the team's recommendations every week at MaximumFun.org. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the sextastic Colin Anderson.
Woo! MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.